I now want to move on to look at God as Father. In an earlier lecture, I suggested something which I've got no real reason to think could be right, but it's a hunch I've got, that in a lot of the early religions, and still currently, Mother Goddess is very important. In the Jewish faith, I think that was an impossible image. And the reasons were, as best I understand them, a lack of knowledge of biology. It was assumed, and in fact till a few centuries ago, that the male semen was actually a living human being, and that male semen was placed in the earth, the mother's womb, which then was the nurturing element, like a seed from a tree landing in the ground and then nurtured by the warm earth. So the woman's role was not producing life, but nurturing it in its very vulnerable stages. But the life itself was something that the male produced and then gave to his wife to nurture. We know that's wrong. But if that's what you think, that that's your overall arching image, then of course you can't imagine God as female, because God isn't the one receiving and nurturing life. God is the source of life. Therefore, necessarily, the male image comes in and takes over. This was still the case in Jesus' day, and in many religions it is now. So if you're going to have monotheism, it had to be male. I can't put it any clearer than you. I think that's the reason. Of course, there's a very beautiful way of imagining God male. But we know God is neither male nor female. But imagining God as male is obviously a very beautiful thing. And we do it because Jesus did it. But today, we're in a perfect position to imagine God equally as female. Like any image of love is to be transferred, if that's the right word, onto our concept of God. So God is a loving father and a loving mother. Well, you know that, isn't even the slightest problem with it. But the liturgy still is entirely male unless the priest shifts it a bit as he reads it. Having said that, let me take you through the lovely imagery from the Old Testament about God being our Father. Like a father, Yahweh accepts the king as his adopted son. 2 Samuel, I will be a father to him, he will be a son to me. And Psalm 2, verse 7, a psalm sung at the coronation of the king. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Well, he's already a man of 18 or 19 or 20 or whatever age he might happen to be. And God's begetting is, of course, metaphorically. So like a father, Yahweh cares for the orphans as his own. And you can, by the way, in the Greek literature, you'll find you could put Zeus in here and it would be perfect. Zeus was the father, the one who cared for widows and orphans in the Greek world. And Zeus was the father of all the gods. Well, like a father, Yahweh cares for them. Here it is, Psalm 68. Father of orphans and protector of widows is God in his holy habitation. This is just the image. These are quite lovely. Yahweh's feelings are like those of a father. Hosea 1:11-8. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. Hosea is one of the two prophets who are preaching in the northern kingdom, in his case, just before the collapse of Samaria. So here he is, the country's in a heck of a mess, and this lovely, sensitive prophet realizes that God can't want this mess. He recoils from it. because God is the one, like a father, who is compassionate, warm and tender. Jeremiah, living a generation later, two generations later, at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, I thought you'd call me my father, he says to the people, and would not turn from following me. Return, faithless children. I will heal your faithlessness. Again, Jeremiah, is Ephraim my dear son? Is he the child I delight in? As often as I speak against him, I still remember him. Therefore, I'm deeply moved for him. I will surely have mercy on him, says Yahweh. They're quite tender passages, really. Insights that these prophets had into the mystery of God. It's Jesus' practice of addressing God as Abba, which is Aramaic for my father, my dear father. It is this practice that accounts for this being a favourite address among Jesus' disciples. It accounts for the opening statements of the creed. I believe in God, the Father, Almighty Creator of heaven and earth. Jesus addresses the one and only God as Abba, Father. Jesus' disciples continue this practice, for the God of Jesus is our God, and the intimate relationship that Jesus had with God is the relationship that Jesus shares with us. The fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, has Jesus say to Mary of Magdala after the resurrection, go to my brothers and say to them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. However, and you won't be as familiar with this, I want to now look at God as Mother. Of course, in calling God Father, we're using an analogy from our own experience of a father at its best. We're speaking in metaphors. We've come to realise, as I mentioned earlier, that mother, though less commonly used, is an equally appropriate metaphor for God. Because the ancients were ignorant of the process of conception, Jews followed by Christians couldn't address God as mother, since God is the source of life, not the receiver of it. With the change in our understanding of the process of conception, we can speak of God as mother or father. One of the saddest things, I reckon, is, especially today, it's critically important, we can be so slow to take on the advances that science has brought us. We have advanced knowledge in some areas, but we stay with the tried and tested formulas of years past, which means we're no longer communicating insightfully to those who are growing up in a different world. The Catechism says, thank God, number 239, God's parental tenderness can also be expressed by the image of motherhood. So that enables me to continue this lecture. We reflect upon the ancient tradition of the Christian community, which speaks of God and Christ as our mother. Here's St. Augustine, his commentary on Psalm 101:7, which talks about the pelican in the desert. And he writes, Christ exercises fatherly authority and maternal love, just as Paul is also father and mother through the gospel preaching. And here's a very lovely statement from St. Paul. Well, it's not there for some reason, so I'll just read it to you. This is Paul writing to the Thessalonians. Some people I've heard, they still think Paul is anti-feminist, and I just give him an 800-page book, lend it to them and say, go and read something. Well, get your brain in order. Paul's anything but anti-feminine. Anyhow, this is, listen, if you ever heard of a male chauvinist in a pub talking like this, well, tell me about it. This is Paul. Oh, no, it's not. It's here. Paul writing to his Thessalonians. He says, "We were gentle among you, like a mother tenderly caring for her own children. So deeply do we care for you that we're determined to share with you not only the gospel of God, but also our own selves, because you've become very dear to us." Then he goes on. "You remember our labour and toil, brothers and sisters. We worked night and day so that we mightn't burden any of you while we proclaimed the gospel of God to you. As you know, we dealt with each one of you like a father with his children." So, both different images, but complementary for Paul working with his people. St. Anselm, Bishop of Canterbury, 1100 and something, in his prayer to St. Paul, he writes, talking about Paul, "You too, good Jesus, are not you also a mother? Is not he a mother who, like a hen, gathers his chicks beneath his wings? Truly, Lord, you are a mother too." He's referring to these words of Jesus, which you know. "How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. But you were not willing." In the previous lecture, we reflected on the fact that the notion that best points towards the mystery of God is the notion that God is infinite love. Love communion. The love best seen in the communion between Jesus and God. "My God and your God," he said. And experience in the community that enjoys communion in the Spirit of Jesus. Creation then is best understood as a finite sharing in and expression of this divine love. Creation, quote Isaiah, which is quoted in the Catechism, "Creation is full of the radiant glory of God and is therefore essentially good." And now I want to, in fact, conclude this much shorter session, this one, on angels, because the Catechism treats of angels. But as I talk about angels with you, please keep in mind the Church's teaching of the hierarchy of truths. Or rather than hierarchy, I actually like to think of all the truths of our faith as like concentric circles. So right at the very core centre, you've got the Incarnation, the Trinity, the whole mystery of Jesus and all that's involved. And then there's a little circle around that with other truths without which you can't make sense of the core. And then it goes out and out and out and out. Out here you'll get little practices that happen in Perugia or South America or Ireland or something, and they won't have anything to do with you, you know, but they're still part of this penumbra, as it were. But somewhere in there angels fit, but they're not in the centre. And they're about halfway out, I'd say, or a little bit further. So while they're part of our language, part of our tradition, part of our, we might say, our Catholic faith, for some of you they'll be more important than others, and that's fine, but they're not core. I don't think you'd become a martyr for it. You'd probably say, "Oh, well, you know, please yourself, really, I'm not that, whatever. And I'm talking as someone called Michael, who is one of the archangels. So surely, I have some rights in this matter." No. The existence, Catechism number 328, "the existence of the spiritual, non-corporeal beings that sacred scripture usually calls angels is a truth of our faith." But as I said, it's halfway out to the circumference. It's necessary to remember that our imagination and understanding are adequate only for what we directly experience with our senses. That's where language, it stops, it has to become metaphor and analogy beyond that. This is the best language we can get of practical things that we actually experience. When the ancient texts, this is a fact, of the Hebrew scriptures speak about the angel of Yahweh, you might imagine, or you probably don't now, but some people would imagine that it's not talking about God, it's talking about an angel, an unnamed spiritual creature. Well, it's not. The angel of Yahweh is God in the biblical texts. God, as we experience God mediated through the messages, through people, through events, through the storm, it was a way of keeping God transcendent, because you can't experience God directly, you can't see God, but you can see the angel of God, the messenger of God. It might be a storm, might be a rainbow, it might be a break in the clouds, it might be a person who comes by, but it's really God we're talking about being present. The naming of angels in the Bible indicates aspects of God's presence and action. For example, if you knew Hebrew, you'd know that Gabriel is the word for the Semitic high god, El. So Gabriel is, Gabor is a warrior, El is God. So my warrior God is what Gabriel means. So when Gabriel appears, it means God is appearing as the powerful God who's doing something new, creating something. Raphael, Rapha means to heal. So Raphael is God, El, the healer, healing God. Michael is made up of three words in Greek. Mi is who, ka is like, El is God. So who is like God? It's another way of saying you can't compare anyone to God. There's nothing that you can compare to God. God is unique, beyond everything, etc. So Michael, when Michael appears, Michael is the one who chased Lucifer out of heaven. Well, help us, you're dealing with drama there, for God's sake. So they're the names that they often give, and they've got meanings. In later Judaism, through Persian influence, Iran, the texts start to speak of these immortal, non-material beings, imagined as in attendance on God's throne, ready to carry out God's will. And there's nothing to stop there being such creatures. I mean, we've got rocks and we've got plants and we've got human beings. Why not have intellectual, spiritual creations, creatures? There's nothing wrong with it, of course. And it's kind of likely, really. And it's part of our faith, but as I say, it's edging. In the New Testament, this image permeates the mentality of the whole New Testament as well. While our faith includes acknowledgement of the existence of certain spiritual realities, we should be careful in speculating further as to their nature. People do. They've choirs of angels, you've heard about them all, and there's this and there's that. And one of the jokes used to be about the scholastics, that they were arguing about how many angels can sit on the edge of a pin. It was a takeaway, an easy kind of target joke. But we've got to be careful about all this. God wills, this is the last thing I want to say about angels, God wills the interdependence of all creation. It's all connected. So if there are angels, and I assume there are, and it's a general part of my faith that there are, but they don't have much to do with... But if they are angels, they must have something to do with me and my world. And that little picture that we all saw as children in primary school of an angel with two little children coming to a bridge, wasn't it? It probably looks like we all saw it. And there's the angel protecting the little children as they cross the bridge. Why not? I mean, that's kind of nice, really, to have an angel. Well, God's protecting them is the point. But is God protecting them? Some children fall, do you know, some people. So it's just a general reaching out to God to care for us and to protect us. And the angels are a beautiful image of it, as long as we see them as a statement from God of his care. Oh, the quote I'm giving you there is, God wills, this is the Catechism, number 340, the interdependence of creatures, the sun and the moon, the cedar and the tiny flower, the eagle and the sparrow, the spectacle of their countless diversities and inequalities tells us that no creature is self-sufficient. Creatures exist, the Catechism continues, only in dependence on each other, to complete each other, in the service of each other. So the angels need us, and we need the angels, and the world needs the angels, and the angels need the world, and they're a mysterious presence that we can't see because they've got no body and no matter, as we define them. And if they mean a lot to you, I'm really happy for you.